Hi, I'm David Korn.
And I'm Jim Pinkerton.
And together,
we're blogginghead.tv. Hey, we did it.
Now, I noticed, Jim, there recently was this gigantic celebration across the land of the fifth-year anniversary of Bloggingheads TV. And on that solemn and celebratory occasion, the good people at Bloggingheads TV, the thousands of engineers they have putting this together, produced more than one blooper reel, and on more than one of them, we seem to be prominently featured.
Right. All those engineers, all those creative people, all those artists and writers and dancers and so on they have working on the Blogging Heads team. And yes, I'm sure it was with nothing but admiration and affection for us that we featured so prominently in the blooper reel.
Well, I'm committed to giving them less material to use for the 10th year celebration of Blogging Heads TV. Are you with me on that?
Well, yes, but the flesh may fail us yet.
As it
anyway,
so often does.
Okay. Well,
I just came back from a White House press briefing. Actually, they call it a gaggle, not a briefing. This is when they turn the cameras off, and you can't record it or burst it, but it's all on the record. And in fact, it was tweetable. People following David Korn DC on Twitter could almost be in the room.
Could I do that too?
You could do that too. You could almost be like feeling there. And it wasn't just Robert Gibbs, as is the usual person at the White House press briefings. It was Larry Summers, from Harvard University, and David Axelrod, the chief strategist at the White House. And it was all about talking about the tax cut deal and how wonderful portions of it are from the White House point of view. They didn't make news. Well, I guess there was one piece of news, and that was the use of a scare tactic. Now, it might be an accurate scare tactic, but Larry Summers said, I'm not sure this was in response to a question from me, but was close to a question from me, in which he said, if this package doesn't go through, I don't have my notes in front of me, but he basically said we materially increase the risk of the economy stalling and there being a double dip. That's a pretty big charge from the top economist at the White House, that if you don't pass this package, you run the risk of a double dip recession. It was clearly a message
to those
Democrats. Go ahead.
To you. It was a message to you.
I think it was more a message to the House Democrats and a few Senate Democrats who have been and remain as of this taping very upset with the deal. Barney Frank, shortly before this press gaggle, said he would vote against this. Chris Van Hollen, who was part of the negotiating team, said that if they didn't change the estate tax provision, then he might vote against it. So there's been, you know, somewhat of a Democratic rebellion. And so I think Summers, and then this line was echoed by David Axelrod, you know, were basically saying, are you guys willing to vote against this and play dice with the economy? Because and this is the argument that they've made publicly and privately, that if you vote against this, then what happens? What happens? It will take weeks, months, maybe, to get some other deal, and the deal presumably, from their perspective, won't be as good as the one the White House got. And in the meantime, taxes will go up on everybody. You won't have these other stimulative provisions that they've put into this deal, and the economy could falter.
Yeah.
When you get into who's right, who's wrong in terms of economic predictions, it's kind of a mug's game. But this package versus nothing, it's quite clear that there will be some stimulative effect from this versus doing nothing. So I think it's a pretty potent argument. And it went a little bit further, I think, than what the president said when he came out with his press conference on Tuesday and defended the deal.
Right. The president on Tuesday was saying we can't be pure, we can't be sanctimonious, and now Summers is saying we can't go into recession. But I will make a prediction to you, David. I'll bet you that a higher percentage of the liberal, left, progressive, whatever you want to call them, pundits continue to oppose this deal than do Democratic members of Congress.
Well, it depends what you mean. I mean, yesterday I was on the air with one of our blogging heads comrades, Ezra Klein, who said once he started looking at the deal, it was a lot better than he expected. And that's what Kevin Drum said at our own page, Kevin Drum, who blogs from MotherJones.com, and other sort of policy-minded, progressive voices. And it's sort of where I've moved to. I mean, it's a better deal than just you get tax cuts for the rich and we get tax cuts for the middle class. I think the White House was able to shove a lot into this from a progressive view. That's good economically. I think it comes at an exceedingly high cost in terms of the estate tax provisions and the temporary extension of the Bush tax cuts for the upper end brackets. I mean, just in terms of numbers, it's just a lot of money. But there's on the policy side, there's been some, not happy, but I'm not as upset as I thought I might be. On the political side, if we look at the House Democrats, liberals, there still is a lot of passion and anger. And it was interesting. I was doing a lot of the tweeting on this yesterday during the president's news conference, and I was taking more of a skeptical view, at least of the political end of all this. And the people who were responding, and you remember, people who respond are always usually angry one way or the other. It's not a truly scientific sampling. But I found a real clear division between Obama supporters who were hailing him as a pragmatic hero who got the best deal possible, and Obama supporters who said that they never want to vote for this guy again. I mean, it was a real kind of a cleavage there between the two sides. And how that gets reflected on the Hill, in the political press, on cable talk shows, I don't know. But I think I don't think the ground is completely firm yet on where everybody is standing.
Well, okay, that is interesting. I mean, it sounds to me like Obama's going to win.
I think he probably wins because all the Republicans will be voting for this. So he doesn't
Not all, apparently.
I mean, there's far more Democratic dissatisfaction than Republican dissatisfaction. I mean, I'm in a way stunned. I think it shows that except for like Jim DeMint, one or two others who may vote against it. Any Republican who votes against this loses their little membership card in the deficit hawk secret meeting clubhouse. I mean, for these guys to say, okay, we're going to give the Democrats everything they want and not care about whether we pay for it, and give all these tax cuts to the wealthy and not care how we pay for it, but the deficit is the number one issue.
I wrote in Politico yesterday in their little arena section that this demonstrates once again that economic growth and so on will always trump deficit reduction. I mean, this just proves how hollow the Pete Petersonites are as a group. They could be so easily blown away by a deal like this, which I suspect,
but you're saying
it's going pretty comfortably.
But it seems to me it shows, at least on the Republican side, that really all they care about, the thing they care about the most, and they put every other principle, they're sacrificed every other principle on this altar, is tax cuts for the wealthy.
No, I think the real issue here is starving the beast. I think that's what it boils down to.
Hey, say that again. I missed
starving the beast, as they
starving
say.
The beast,
as in don't give the government money. It only encourages them. I think that's much more
the beast here. They're going ahead with Keynesian politics.
Well, I think their view is that
they'd rather tax cuts for the rich and let the Democrats have these progressive tax policies, the expanding the EITC and tax credits for college and more children's tax credits. They'd rather do that as long as they get their tax credits for the rich.
Well, I think they could have put up no fight
against this stuff. They said this is all we care about, and you can load this up. So I think politically Obama's mishandled it, because I think in a lot of ways he got stuff. He accepted stuff that he said he would never accept, and he also got stuff that Republicans said they never would support.
Did he say he'd never accept it? I'm just for fun. Never.
Well, I mean,
he certainly opposed it. We know that.
During the campaign, he was very clear that he was against extending the Bush tax cuts for the well-to-do. That's my word, not his. But he took as firm a stand as a candidate can on this issue. So. He claims he's showing himself to be pragmatic. He's pointing out that he hates these other provisions, but he thinks that this is what he has to agree to do what he believes is necessary to help middle and low income Americans. And on the Republican side, I see them as saying, what I thought they cared most about was getting a handle on the deficit.
I don't know any Republican except. Members of the board.
Well, wait a second. That's what the whole Tea Party election was about.
No, it's against big government.
It was about too much government spending.
Too much government spending.
And also another issue, too much government spending.
Right.
And yet, here they are saying yes to a lot of government spending because they get tax cuts for the rich out of it.
No, because they're starving the beast. I'm just telling you what they think they're doing. I mean, it's not tax cuts for the rich. It is the only way to shrink the government is to choke off its supply.
Well, they said yes to more spending.
Well, they didn't have a choice. They didn't have a choice. I mean, they weren't going to get the extension of the Bush tax cuts.
They could have made a decision that controlling spending was more important to them than tax cuts for the rich.
They could have made the decision to do that.
They went for tax cuts for the rich, and they said okay to all the spending.
You're entitled to do this, but every time you say it, I'll say you're incorrect. You're entitled to say that the entire Republican agenda is tax cuts for the rich. You're entitled to say that. I'm going to simply say to you that I probably know more Republicans than you do, and that's not what they think. They think something different than what you're saying.
You can think 2 + 2 = 5. That doesn't make it right. And this deal, they accepted far more government spending. This is just a fact. They accepted far more government spending than they're getting in terms of tax cuts for the rich. Maybe before this deal and after this deal, they think that they're about something else. But this is kind of a definitional moment for all sides.
And here they were saying,
okay, we'll give you all this government spending. After all this talking about earmarks and how we have to really draw the line, they threw the line overboard. That's a great mixed metaphor, isn't it? And they said, as long as they got the tax cuts for the rich.
You can throw a line overboard. It happens.
A lifeline, perhaps.
I would say, look, Grover Norquist said, listen, this is, we're not going to...
A hush falls over the crowd.
Well, it does.
Grover Norquist
said. In Republican circles, it does. That's my point. And he is not for more spending. He's for holding the line on taxes. And I think that's the view Republicans arrived at on this issue. But... I think we've made news here. We've just simply arrived at an interesting point, which is for all the furor on MSNBC and Ed Schultz calling Obama every name in the book, we both agree this thing is likely to pass. Okay, that's to me that's interesting.
I think it's likely to pass because I think most Republicans are, I think, a great majority of Republicans are for it, and probably enough Democrats are going to be there. I mean, today Dick Durbin, more or less said that he thought Obama had shown great leadership ability in putting this deal together. So that sounds like he's going to go for it. He's the number two man in the Senate. One issue we'll see in the next few days of how this plays out, whether this deal is a locked box and can't be tinkered with, because once you start doing that, it can just all fall apart, or whether there's a possibility that there can be any additional horse trading on Capitol Hill that brings more members on. That question was asked repeatedly of David Axelrod, Robert Gibbs, and Larry Summers at the press briefing, and their line essentially was, "We don't see how how that works. If someone wants to try it and it works, it's okay. But we just, you know, they think they have a pretty delicate balance that they've devised with the Republicans, and that it has to more or less stay that way to keep moving forward.
So but,
things do unravel.
This was done in the White House briefing room? Where did they do this?
Yeah, this was in the White House briefing room.
So you're sitting here, no cameras, and you're sitting there tweeting away on while they're talking?
That's right.
Well, that's kind of an odd compromise they've reached. You know, no cameras, but you can tweet. I mean, how about, I guess a cell phone camera, that would be kind of...
Well, a camera is a camera. You're not supposed to broadcast. And I think, you know, in part, you know, it was more of the, I think, the issue of just, you know, broadcasting it live. When you tweet, you know, you get a few quotes out, and it's a lot of paraphrasing. But, I mean, there was a protest registered by, believe it or not, the TV people.
They just fell in the line and just sat there and took notes too.
Well, they could have walked out if they wanted to, I suppose. But and for us print and tweet people, this is really inside baseball here. We often prefer the gaggle because then it's a little more informal, and Robert Gibbs tends to bounce around the room more, and there's less time spent on the TV people, and they more time for the rest of us.
When you have just one last question, and we'll get off this.
Okay.
When you're doing a regular gaggle with regular press conference with reporters and TV cameras going, are you entitled to hold up your cell phone and just film it away for the entire hour too?
Oh yeah. People do that. I mean, so but you know, you have all the networks, you know, filming it. You have C-SPAN filming it. So if you're standing there, you could, you know, use your own handheld flip camera if you want to, and broadcast it.
So there's no kind of division. Okay, very good. Yeah. So all right, I think we've covered that. We know your position on Republicans and tax cuts to the rich.
Well, I think to me, this is just, you know, I think really one of the fascinating moments in Washington with the intersection of politics and policy, and watching, you know, just how the process works, you know, what the reactions are inside Washington and outside Washington. You know, this is perhaps even worthy of a book, this one moment. Now, it could all fall apart, which would make it in some ways more interesting and less interesting. But there are people, you know, calling this the end of the Obama presidency. There are people calling this, you know, the icebreaker on what will happen the next 2 years in terms of the Republicans and the Obama White House reaching compromises on the pressing issues of the day.
Right. Do you have any doubt anymore that Obama will triangulate?
Well, it depends on what issues. I mean, at the same time this is going on, there's also the possibility, and Obama's been working on this, for a vote on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and on the Dream Act. So the thing, you know, liberal issues that he's not running away from. So Clinton had a lot of an easier time triangulating because the issues that he triangulated upon were in some ways not always as big. Welfare reform perhaps being the biggest of them, and I'm not saying it's not important, but when it comes to, you know, but Obama's already triangulated on, say, Afghanistan, which he's going to continue to have to do, and well, you know, I don't think dumping the public option was an act of triangulation, but, you know, he's calculating about what he can do, and in talking to some of the folks near him in the last day or two, what's impressed me, and I don't mean that as a positive thing, but, you know, what sort of registered with me was Obama, you know, in every meeting apparently that he had on this issue, kept looking around the room and telling, there were people who were advocating fighting more, holding the line more, and he kept saying, what are the consequences if we do that for the people out there who need unemployment insurance, who need these tax credits, and delaying the tax cuts on the middle class. So even if it becomes retroactive, if you get this done, say 3 months from now or 6 months from now, what's the impact on them in January when their paycheck shrinks? And, you know, it sort of, I think, brings home the point of the, you know, the burden or the responsibility of being the person who makes the decision. And, you know, you and I, in our own separate ways, are, you know, part of our job is giving advice to presidents and leaders all the time, and what we think is right, what we think is best politically, and so on. But the way, you know, that people describe how, you know, the view that he was taking on this, just, you know, for, you know, it's, for me, it was, you know, it was significant. And so I feel, if anything, just getting a little warm and personal and fuzzy here, a little less inclined to be overly judgmental on this matter when looking at it from that perspective.
Yeah, you know, I have to say I kind of agree with you. I thought his press conference yesterday, where he said, "Look, this country was founded on compromise," you know, literally. You know, the whole 5/8 of a person business and so on.
And I thought he was referring to the fact that, you know, John Adams and others wanted to, you know, almost cut, you know, kill the Declaration of Independence if it didn't mention, you know, slavery.
Right, and they came up with the famous compromise that a slave was 5/8 of a person. And he said, "Look, you know, there was a time I couldn't have walked to the front door of this place." And then he said, "You know, look, there wouldn't have been a union," and he meant capital U union. Yeah. I had the same thought. He was sort of showing a awareness of history and the need for compromises, which tells me that, you know, again, I think that means, you know, triangulation is a nasty way to put it. You know, Henry Clay, you know, the great compromiser, you know, that was a compliment to Henry Clay.
I mean, before people write in and ask if I've drunk any Kool-Aid, I mean, I would like to amend my comments and say that I do think politically they've, you know, really botched this, and that this deal that they have would have been better if it had come at the end of a more defining political fight that would show, you know, Republican obstructionism and extremism and all that. I think they kind of got there too fast and without winning the narrative. One of my least favorite cliches here in Washington. But since that didn't happen, and you can't go back to November or May and make it happen again, you know, just, you know, so given that he sort of, you know, I think dropped the ball on that front, you know, looking at, you know, the deal itself, and, you know, and getting a sense of how he thought about it, which I have to say, as an American, I feel kind of privileged to be able to talk to people who were in the room and can give me a little sense of this. I'm glad to share it with you out there in bloggingheads.tv land. It's at least, you know, it takes a little hubris out of being a pundit.
Well, I agree. Okay, fair enough. I would also add, since we don't come across as too being stuck up to power here, that, and I would just point out that Obama had 22 months as president before this whole little crisis to make his argument for what he wanted tax wise.
And did he screw that up? Let me get on that.
I think the reality is, and Paul Krugman kind of let the cat out of the bag, that a lot of them didn't want any taxes. They wanted the taxes to go up come January of 11, and they were perfectly happy to see them all expire. And that's why they didn't bother to do the set aside for under 250 or under a million or whatever number they were picking. When they clearly had the votes, they could have said, "Okay, here's our new rule about the Bush tax cuts or the Obama tax increase, if you prefer," and they chose not to do it, which tells me a lot about where they really were headed, and reminds me as a Republican that elections do have consequences, and the course of Obama's presidency, maybe to Obama's benefit, frankly, in terms of him triangulating his way to reelection, was changed pretty decisively on November 2nd.
Okay, this has been consuming me the last day or two. What else do you want to talk about?
WikiLeaks.
WikiLeaks, that was consuming me before this was consuming me.
I think it's an ongoing story.
So should we put him away for life or execute him? What's your position?
I'm not sure what law we have on him. I mean,
Your old pal Mike Huckabee literally called for his execution.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, actually, he said execution is not good enough. So I guess he was calling for drawn and quartering in the public square. And we can put it on YouTube.
When you're drawn and quartered, there's no law there. You're just doing it. You're that mad. My comment on this is, look, I'm not a lawyer. I don't want to get in the weeds on. You know, what law they could try him under, the Espionage Act of 1917. What I find just interesting is, and again, I guess it goes back to what we were saying before about the mechanics of the press corps. You were talking about Twitter and, you know, so on and so on, and when cameras can be there, is it seems to me that Julian Assange, and I would imagine 100 more wannabes who can figure out how to hack, you know, the White House or the U.S. Congress or...
But he didn't get this through hacking. Remember that?
Okay, or downloading, or just
whatever mechanism,
including,
a leaker.
I mean, I don't think he was legally allowed to do what he did. But I agree. It was.
That's a different note. If you go back to the Pentagon case, if someone who has access to top secret documents takes them and gives them to you, Jim Pinkerton, or to me, David Korn, and then we, you know, write stories about them, give them to the New York Times, post them, we're not prosecutable. You know, they do try to come up with some creative ways, like, you know, if you induce the person who leaked to leak to you, if you conspired. I mean, there are all these things that they can try to wrap you on. But the essence of the Pentagon Papers case was that the New York Times and the Washington Post could go ahead and publish this stuff no matter how it had gotten to them.
Right. And I understand. So I was talking about the alleged actions of Private Manning, who, I guess,
yes,
was in the
Clinton Private First Class, Bradley Manning, which is, if you don't know, you know, he worked in the military and he had access to, you know, to computer networks that had all the, you know, had the Iraq war cables, it had Afghanistan military videos, and it had these 251,000 State Department cables as well.
Right. So he just, I suspect that he was not supposed to do what he did.
That's why he's in the brig.
Right. That's why he's
and
in the brig.
That's why he'll probably never see him.
He'll be in the clink for a long time. My point was, in some sense, since he took stuff that he wasn't supposed to take, right, you could call that, in a general, non-technical sense, hacking or stealing or filching or whatever you want to call it. And my point was, I think there'll be. It's clear to me that so many of these systems are vulnerable, and that the upside of fame and notoriety and revenge, which is oftentimes a motive in these things, or to just make them look bad, is so colossal. You know, Julian Assange is a, you know, if there's any justice, I mean, he'd be right up there in the Man of the Year thing, you know, including
actually, I think his name was taken off the Man of the Year Time poll.
I think that probably was a mistake in terms of, I mean, look, the Time magazine Man of the Year has kind of been corrupted ever since they put Giuliani on in 2001 as opposed to Bin Laden. I mean, I lost faith in that Man of the Year poll. No, seriously, I'm a fan of Giuliani, not a fan of Bin Laden, but Bin Laden is a guy who changed the history.
That's why they've had Hitler and Stalin on the cover in years past.
Exactly, they had Hitler and Stalin in the past.
A lot of people have sort of asked me, you know, what my position is on what WikiLeaks has done. And, you know, the journalist in me, you know, is just amazed to have this treasure trove. And I've written several stories in the past week off the cables, that stories that eluded the Times and the Guardian, because they just didn't pick up on them, because they've literally had so much to process that it's left a lot of other great material out there. The notion, though, of dumping, you know, 251,000 documents without sort of processing them, is something that, you know, does worry me a bit on the citizen side of the street. Now, unlike the previous dumps that WikiLeaks has done, they did go through this and they took out names and they redacted things that they thought could lead to people being harmed or injured. So they learned from the previous criticism of their dumps and tried to be more responsible. They even asked the State Department for guidance on what they should, what they should keep secret. And the State Department wouldn't participate because they didn't want to sanction the whole activity. We want diplomats and intelligence officers even who are doing the right things to protect us and protect others to have the type of secrecy that is necessary. Unfortunately, as is shown again and again in our government, we have a overabundance of secrecy, and things are classified, or, you know, often for reasons not of national security, but of either habit or to protect embarrassment, to protect from embarrassment.
Right, and you raise an interesting point, which is kind of what I'm struggling to get at here, and in fact, I'm struggling to articulate to myself even, and that is, okay, in the past, we all remember Jack Anderson and David Wise, and,
Well, I think you should know. I think you should spell out for some people who
Oh, Jack Anderson was a famous investigative reporter, columnist for the Washington Post. Probably died a few years ago, but he retired a while back. But in the 70s,
there is a great, let me just interrupt to do a commercial plug. My friend Mark Felstein wrote a tremendous book on him called "Poisoning the Press," which came out just a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
That if you care about the journalism and you care about Richard Nixon, because he battled with Nixon, it's a great read.
Anyway, or if you care about the history of the 1970s,
and
probably, I guess, the 60s, too. That's a little before my time. But certainly, I can remember reading Anderson and you know, all the leaks he had and so on. And then David Wise, I remember reading his book, The Politics of Lying, I think it was called, in high school or junior high school, like 71, 72.
And he had a book before, he had one of the first books, really, on the CIA that exposed a lot of CIA operations and activity that people had not even been able to dream of. That was, I believe, in the 60s.
Okay, so there's two points here. One is both Wise and Jack Anderson were Americans, I mean, American citizens.
Right.
And we can presume, just because we have faith in our fellow citizens, that they were trying to walk the line between legitimately speaking truth to power, you know, the Johnson administration, the Nixon administration, and endangering national security, okay, and not everybody does that, of course, but we can say they did, and they died as respected figures. I know Anderson died. I don't think Wise was around either. But now we have this new phenomenon where people who aren't Americans and who might not like America at all and might be in cahoots with enemies or just might be just anarchists or who knows what they are, seem to have sort of equal access to, or even more access to, these documents. I mean, you know, David, if somebody handed you 251,000 documents, you know, I think, that, as you just sort of said you would, you know, I'd be kind of conscious of protecting, you know, not getting people killed and, you know,
And often these are hard calls. I mean, we see this all the time when the New York Times, you know, did their story on NSA intercepts and so on. You know, sometimes Bill Keller, the editor of the New York Times, will meet, you know, with representatives of the White House or the CIA or whatever, and talk about it and say, okay, what's your argument for keeping the secret? And you know, listen, and sometimes they sit on information for a year and then, well, you know, things change and they'll go with it. Sometimes they don't accept the arguments of the government. And you know, I did a book on a fellow who was in the CIA a few years ago. It was called Blonde Ghost. And I interviewed hundreds of people, over 100 ex-CIA people. And some let me use their names. Others, who I knew the names of some people, and I could have put them in the book. But these people often made the argument for me that they still work overseas, they travel with their family. And if I really, really, really didn't have to use their name, could I avoid it? And in most cases, I said yes. It wasn't necessary for the story. But you know, sometimes these calls are tougher than other calls. And but now, if we have just these gigantic, you know, downloads, and they're going to be crowdsourced, and people can sort of pick through them, it's really going to change the nature of things. But as journalists are wont to say, you know, ultimately, the responsibility for responsible secret keeping rests on the government, and the argument that has long been made. Daniel Patrick Moynihan had a whole secrecy commission. He was a senator, passed on a couple of years ago. You know, he made the argument at the time that actually, the fewer secrets you have, usually the better able you're going to be to keep them, and the more value they will have, and the more people will actually respect their secrecy. When everything is a secret, then people don't take it seriously.
Right. I
think there's a lot of merit to that.
He's exactly right. I mean, Moynihan was a great man. I mean, I guess the challenge comes is when does a journalist morph or slide over on the continuum into an enemy? Again, Jack Anderson and David Wise lived in America, were content to work within the American system, never renounced their citizenship, never worked for the Soviets, you know, and so on.
They were exposing, you know, government duplicity with Nixon in particular, but in other ways, again and again and again. So it wasn't just it wasn't like they were close to the enemies. They were actually engaging what I and others would consider to be a patriotic responsibility.
Fair enough. And Julian Assange would make pretty much same argument for himself.
There is an interesting distinction here with Julian Assange, who is an Australian, not an American. I don't think that matters that much. But what he is, you know, he is not, you know, particularly with this leak, this by dumping 251,000 documents, and they're not all out in public yet, but they are all within the hands of his media partners, which include the British newspaper The Guardian, Der Spiegel, and the New York Times, sort of more indirectly this time around. I won't bother explaining why, but his argument is that he's against secrecy, that he's in favor of transparency. So it's not the usual argument that a journalist will make. If I get secrets and I publish them, I'm doing it because of this reason. It shows that the government is telling us the truth, or some program happened that I believe the public should know about because it was done in their name, whatever. He is just saying he wants greater transparency. It's a much more abstract and a wider critique. He also doesn't like America's role in the world, which is tandem to this call for more transparency. But it's a wider and it's it's not a discriminating view.
And right. So what happens? You're sitting there in the White House, and Robert Gibbs is saying something, or Larry Summers, or David Axelrod, or something like that, and you're sitting there trying to figure out are they right? Are they wrong? Are they telling the truth? Or whatever. And then, meanwhile, the new journalism turns out to be some intern who just simply hands out every email that Axelrod, Summers, and Gibbs have sent to each other in the last 2 years. I mean, I think that kind of stuff is coming, just from sort of a technical point of view. And so who's the real journalist now?
You've
got the job, you've got the press pass, you've got the big pen and the forum.
And Julian Assange doesn't, call himself a journalist. He is a whistleblower, an information source, and it's kind of interesting in a journalistic exercise to compare what the newspapers who have access to all 251,000 documents, what each one is playing up and how they're playing it up and what they're finding interesting and how they're reporting. Of course, there are differences because they represent different countries, so they're going for audiences that have different priorities and different context. But I wonder, to what degree this is really a new day or just a tremendous, exceptional, I don't mean that in a good or bad way, but exceptional episode. Because, this is really based on getting, this one Army private first class who had access to this amount of material, and now so much pressure is being placed on WikiLeaks in terms of the site being hacked and Julian Assange now being arrested on unrelated charges, regarding alleged sexual assault, that, can the WikiLeaks model sustain itself? Can you get these sort of dumps? I mean, if you think about it, between the Pentagon after the Pentagon Papers, it's been, decades since we've had anything of that significance, even though there are still copiers and there are still dissatisfied people inside the bureaucracy. So I would caution people like Mike Huckabee and others not to overreact and say, this is the new information order, and that all our secrets will be pouring out, and we have to start executing people to make sure that doesn't happen.
Well, I think that we're probably more in the new order world, new information order world. There's the architecture of computer systems and so on, including yours, including mine, is so vulnerable to this kind of. I think that take another example. Take China and Google. Among the interesting revelations, which probably should have been factored into more of the public policy discourse than it has been, is, okay, what do we do if China is busy? It's an if. Let's just say it's an allegation, although I'm, if China is actively using its industrial, economic, political resources to steal our intellectual property and hack all our stuff, including Google. Right. And I've now, just reading about surfing around on blogs and stuff, and I've seen first-person accounts of people who got a notice from Google for their Gmail account saying, hey, by the way, the Chinese hacked into this. Who knows why, it'll all get sorted out. But something tells me that, Microsoft and Google and Yahoo and all the rest of them did not adequately build all these systems, including the system we're talking on right now, with an eye toward, seriously smart people with serious intent trying to hack into it. I don't think the systems were built that robustly. to defend that, which tells me that even if the government can now deny access to a private first class sitting in a cubicle in Kuwait or wherever he was, I don't think they'll be able to, without massive retrofitting, I don't think they'll be able to stop the Chinese and the Russians and the whoever's from hacking their way into a lot of stuff, including this infinity of corporate material, which clearly has national security implications. I mean, the countries and the nation as a whole came close to kind of falling off a cliff, two plus years ago over the meltdown and so on. And the power of some company, other country to do that and be in that mix, I think has yet to be factored in.
No, I think you're right. I think it's in looking at a lot of the WikiLeaks documents, you see again and again they have accounts of not just of China messing with Google, but of cyber attacks or threatened attacks or suspected attacks just around the world at all sorts of various targets, not just American targets. And it's it's a little unnerving to read these. I mean, these are kind of routine listings of all the various attacks, and often the systems get attacked because they give you access to a system you really care about. A few years ago, I met a computer forensics person who told me, with a tremendous amount of authority, that the Chinese had hacked, very, very, very thoroughly into the computers at the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank, neoconservative think tank here in town. And it wasn't as if they wanted to get, special updates on the next Newt Gingrich speech. But they realized that the people there, whether it was like a Paul Wolfowitz or somebody, who, while not in power, were still communicating with people with military and addresses and EOP, that's Executive Office of the Presidency addresses, and it was a way to sort of get to the government by going through AEI. I was told that eventually they stopped it, and they never figured out the source. They said that it was coming from China, but a lot of that can be masked these days too. Which makes it really, really, that's the other thing. If you come under attack, it's really easy for someone who can do a sophisticated attack to make it look like it's coming from somewhere else. So in the old, when it comes to nuclear warfare, you usually can tell where the missiles are coming from. But if it's a really gigantic cyber attack, if we ever face something like that, you would assume that the people behind it would be telling you it's coming from Cameroon or something, or
right.
Maybe
right.
Koreans saying it's coming from China or whatever. It's it's very unnerving material, and it's something that I know I know people work on this. There's a lot of work being done within the Justice Department, within the White House, and certainly within the Defense Department on this. Whether it's at all sufficient to whatever the threat may be, I don't think anybody really knows.
Yeah, and just two points. One, the Harvard Business Review had an article last year about the decline of U.S. competitiveness, and one of the illustrations they used to make that was to make their argument that America's competitiveness was falling away was the fact that the United States could not make a Amazon Kindle. We just don't have the capacity. Think of the Kindle as being that complicated, but we can't make it anymore. And they sort of took it apart and said, well, this piece is made in China, this piece is made in South Korea, this part's from Japan, and so on. And, a reminder that if that much foreign technology has, basically every computer in this country is made somewhere else.
Right.
You got to assume that somebody's with some brains has figured out, what do we do therefore when in a crunch moment with the United States? How can we take apart the U.S. Communications network or something, or how can we fool them into thinking that they're being attacked by Russia when it's actually us, the Chinese, doing it, or something like that? The other point is that I sort of had the feeling when the first WikiLeaks came about Iraq, that was 6 months ago now, that the Obama administration didn't really mind. That they sort of said, well, that makes Bush look bad. We're not really going to worry about it. I think then when Afghanistan hit a little while later, that they realized that was sort of hitting more close to home. That was kind of their war now. And now I think they genuinely are furious about the the WikiLeaks, you know, around with Hillary Clinton and so on. But it seems to me, and maybe you can enlighten me on this, that the Justice Department and Attorney General Holder and so on didn't seem very interested in the proverbial all-out plan to counteract WikiLeaks, unless you buy into the theory that the whole Swedish sex thing is some sort of entrapment on him. So what are your comments on that, Mr. Student of the Intelligence Community?
Well, you know, if it was the 1970s, I certainly would say that the odds are high it was entrapment, because I know of cases back then where indeed the CIA tried to do things like, you're close to that. I have absolutely no idea, and just, you know, on whether that's the case now. I mean, Holder has said publicly that he's looking at all the possible legal means, but, you know, this raises a whole other issue. We talk a lot about globalization, but here's a guy who, while he has Australian citizenship, really is, almost is a citizen of no land and moves around a lot and has a network of people to help him. And if all this stuff, it used to be that, journalism happened within the confines of a border. Newspapers printed somewhere, a TV show was broadcast from somewhere, reporters were based in a particular city. I mean, if the government wanted to put pressure on or try to stop publication or do something, you kind of knew where to go. But in this day, it really exists in the cyber ether. And so what you do about, you could indict Julian Assange and not necessarily find a way, extradite him back to the country, and that wouldn't really stop anything. And I suppose it's kind of like Spartacus, that there are 100 others willing to sort of take his place, should you just nail him. And I'm not saying that he's a hero, but so the legal means you have when information, not just capital, not just the flow of money, but now information is transnational. I actually should ask some people about this, but I'm sure that there are a lot of headaches at the Justice Department in the last week about
My point is there should have been some 6 months ago, and there weren't.
I think
this is a case where they didn't quite realize how much exposure they themselves had, not just Bush.
Maybe it's interesting because military, I mean, one day someone will do, one day there'll be a good book on this, and someone will tell us at what point they knew about this cache of documents, because they've had Bradley Manning for a while now, and has he told them everything he gave? I mean, they probably should have been able to figure out what he had access to at the very least, if not precisely what he delivered to WikiLeaks. So there's no doubt in my mind that there's a good chance that they had a fair amount of warning and probably did some real thinking about what, if anything, could be done to stop any of this, and maybe just couldn't come up with the right right alternative, and even execution wouldn't have helped.
Well, I think that, I'll let the record, I think that it, pretty clear that Holder was so paralyzed by, sort of political correctness or just dithering that they didn't have the kind of effort they are probably doing now. They should have had then, and they didn't. And it's just that's what the book, plural. I'm sure there'll be more than one on this. Will tell us. But anyway,
Let's leave it at that.
Let's leave it at that. Like that. That's, we only covered two tops, but that's plenty.
So I'll see you.
At the beginning of another great 5 years here on Blogging Heads.
I hope so.